2006. He's currently a junior fellow at the Harvard Society of Fellows, which is an interesting organization. So according to Wiki, the Harvard Society of Fellows is a group of scholars selected at the beginning of their careers by Harvard University for extraordinary scholarly potential, upon whom distinctive academic and intellectual opportunities are bestowed in order to foster their intellectual growth and intellectual collaboration. Membership of the Society is for life. So that's Michael Levin. He's interested in topological aspects of condensed matter physics, and today he's going to speak on topological insulators and fractionalization.
Thanks for the introduction and for the opportunity to talk here. So what am I going to talk about today? The subject of my talk is a recent breakthrough in our understanding of band insulators. And what makes this breakthrough especially surprising is that, you know, the subject of band insulators is very old. It goes back probably 70 years, 80 years now. And it was thought that there really wasn't much more one could say about them. But recently, it was discovered that there's an entirely new type of band insulator. It's fundamentally different from previously understood insulators. And this new type of band insulator is called a topological insulator. And topological insulators can exist in both two and three dimensions. In this talk, I'm going to focus exclusively on the two-dimensional case. Now, what I'm going to do in this talk is first I'm going to explain to you or review, basically, what we know about topological insulators, how they're different from conventional insulators, how they're realized and seen experimentally. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to discuss work that I did in collaboration with Adi Stern at the Weizmann Institute. And basically, what we tried to understand in one sentence is what happens instead of talking about non-interacting or weakly interacting systems, what happens in strongly interacting systems? Are there analogs of topological insulators in strongly correlated and strongly interacting systems? Okay, so let me begin by reviewing what an insulator is or what a band insulator is. A model of insulators is one of the great triumphs of quantum mechanics, and it's based on the starting point is a very simple model. So the idea is the following. We're going to model a material as a gas of non-interacting electrons moving in a periodic potential created by background ions. And it turns out we can model them as non-interacting. We can basically ignore interactions and get a pretty good description of the system. So we're going to do that. We're going to just think of non-interacting electrons in a periodic potential. So starting from this model, the first thing we want to ask is, what's the spectrum of this model? What are the eigenstates? So to do that, we need to solve the Schrodinger equation in a periodic potential. And the key point there is that since we have this periodicity, because we have this discrete translational symmetry, this simplifies our solution a lot, because it means that momentum is a good quantum number, modulo the inverse lattice spacing. So that means that every eigenstate of the Schrodinger operator can be labeled by a k point, a momentum point in the Brillouin zone, and we can just separately diagonalize the problem at each k instead of having to diagonalize the whole system. Now, suppose we do that. So we diagonalize the system at each k. We can then plot the energies of each of the eigenstates at k as a function of k, and we'll get something like this. It's a band structure where we have energy as a function of k. Now, I should say that in reality, I should have drawn this. E should really be a function of both kx and ky. But for simplicity, I've just shown it as a function of kx because it's just easier to draw. OK, so the idea behind band insulators is that suppose one's in a situation where there's just the right number of electrons, the chemical potential is just right, so that one fills up an integer number of bands. And suppose, in addition, that there's a finite gap separating the occupied or valence band from the unoccupied or conduction band. Then in that case, it's not hard to see that the system will display many of the properties of an insulator, because at low temperatures, to create an electronic-like excitation requires an energy delta, and so these excitations are basically not going to be present in the system, and the system behaves as an inert system, behaves like an insulator. So any material that can be modeled in this way is called a band insulator. Okay, so these are what band insulators are, and now one of the most basic questions one can ask about band insulators is are all band insulators the same? So what do I mean by that? Well, clearly different materials will have different band structures. The energy spectra will look different in different materials, but I want to think about a sort of cruder notion of equivalence. So let's say that two band insulators are the same if one can kind of continuously deform one into the other without closing the band gap. If one can kind of adiabatically connect one to the other. If that's the case, then the two types of insulators will have qualitatively the same types of properties. So it makes sense to kind of think of them as the same, to use that as a definition of equivalence. So the question is, under this cruder notion of equivalence, where we don't worry about details of the energy levels, and we just ask, can one insulator be continuously deformed into another, are they all the same? Well, as I said, the band insulators were first, the theory of, basic model was written down probably 80 years ago, and it was thought for basically all of that time that they're pretty much all the same. They may differ in their details of their energy levels, but they can all be continuously deformed into one another. But recently, it's discovered this is not the case. So it was found that there are actually two distinct kinds of band insulators in time reversal invariant two-dimensional systems. These two types of insulators are conventional insulators, the previously known types of insulators, and a new type of insulator called topological insulators. And they're really fundamentally different. They cannot be continuously deformed into one another. They're in different universality classes, if you like. Now, I've underlined time reversal invariant here because, as we'll see, time reversal invariance plays a very key role in this whole story, and in particular in the distinction between these two types of insulators. Okay, so let me now outline what I'm going to talk about. So first I want to review the basic theory of topological insulators, and I want to explain why there are two types of time reversal invariant insulators in two dimensions, and not six, and not 27, and not one. Then I want to discuss a little bit of what the physical properties of these two types of insulators are, and how they're experimentally realized. In the second part of the talk, I'm going to discuss work that I've worked on, which basically addresses the question of, what happens in strongly correlated systems. Band insulators are sort of by definition weakly interacting systems, or systems that can be understood, modeled as weakly interacting. What happens for systems that are intrinsically strongly interacting or strongly correlated? Is there any analog of these ideas? Okay. So to begin, let me get to this question of why two. So it turns out that the easiest way to understand why there are two types of time reversal invariant insulators in two dimensions is to think about insulators with an edge. So let's imagine we have our simple model here of electrons in a periodic potential, but now we put an edge on the system. There's an edge between our material and the vacuum. So one can imagine if one looks at this system, we don't have translational symmetry in the y direction anymore, right? But we still have translational symmetry in the x direction. So we can still write down a kind of band structure. So momentum in the x direction is still a good quantum number, so modulo the lattice spacing. So we can still write down a band structure as a function of kx. So what happens if we do that? Well, generally, one will get something like this. So what was originally a single valence band in our 2D band structure becomes a continuum of states in this 1D band structure. And what was originally a single conduction band in our 2D band structure becomes a continuum of states in this 1D band structure. And of course, in general, we'll still have a gap delta separating the valence continuum and the conduction continuum. Now, one way to think about this continuum is that basically the different states here correspond to different displacements from the edge. So the, your electron or your state can have different displacements from the edge, and that corresponds to kind of the infinite number of states that lie in each one of these k points. Now, in addition to this conduction and valence continua, it's also possible that you'll see some states in the gap when you go ahead and solve this this problem with an edge. Now, these states, since they live in the gap, that means they can't really exist in the bulk of the sample. Well, they have to be exponentially localized near the edge. So we call them edge modes. So in general, if you take a general energy spectrum with an edge, you'll see something like this. Now, the question I want to ask next is, what happens in the case of a time reversal invariant insulator? What kind of energy spectrum, edge spectrum, does one see there? So the first point to make is that if you have a time reversal invariant system, it's enough. We don't have to draw the whole diagram. It's enough to draw it for k running between 0 and pi, because the other half is completely determined by time reversal symmetry. It has to just be basically a copy of this half of the Rouen zone. So we'll just plot everything from k running from 0 to pi. Now, suppose we do that. So, you know, in general, we're going to see some kind of conduction band, some kind of valence band. And we may see some states in the gap. Now comes a key point. So remember that what we're talking about here is a system of spin one-half electrons. That's what we're interested in. Now, there's a theorem, Cramer's theorem, which tells us that if you have a time reversal invariant system of spin one-half electrons, then at time reversal invariant momenta, every state must be doubly degenerate. There must be a Cramer's degeneracy. So in particular, all the states at k equals 0 and at k equals pi at the two time reversal momenta must be doubly degenerate. In particular, these states are all doubly degenerate. Now, if our system had no kind of spin orbit coupling, if spin was completely decoupled from the other degrees of freedom, then actually every state would be doubly degenerate, because every state, there'd be a state for spin up electrons and a state for spin down electrons. But in general, we will have some kind of, we're interested in systems that do have some kind of spin orbit coupling, which is generically the case. So in general, the degeneracy will only be at these points. When we move away from these points, we'll see some splitting. So,
both have two states. Whether one have a similar thing for photon or no?
Well, we need some kind of version of Cramer's theorem. So we need T squared. So to have a Cramer's theorem, we need, important point is you need sort of T squared equals minus one, which is
difficult to get for T squared is not minus one.
Exactly. You don't have an analog of Cramer's theorem for photons. So in general, these states will be degenerate, but when we move away, we'll see some splitting. So this is sort of what we expect to see. There'll be some splitting as we move away from the two-time reversal momenta. Now, if you look at this picture for a second, you can convince yourself there's sort of two distinct ways we could connect up these points. So one way is to connect them up to form bubbles, sort of like this. And the other way we could connect them up is to form this sort of zigzag pattern, like this. Now, if you look at these two pictures for a little bit, you can kind of convince yourself that these two edge spectra are really fundamentally distinct from one another, topologically distinct from one another. There's no way I could kind of continuously change this type of spectra into this type of spectra without closing the bulk band gap. Now, we can make that a little bit more formal, this intuition, if we count. Let's imagine we count how many times the edge spectra crosses the Fermi energy, or the chemical potential. So on the left-hand side, we can see it crosses twice. On the right-hand side, we can see it crosses once. Now, you could imagine by changing some details at the edge or so on that I could maybe push this bubble up completely so it crosses zero times. Or maybe here I could do something which makes this, you know, change some detail at the edge, which makes this puts in a wiggle, so it crosses three times. But what I can never change is the fact that in this case it crosses an even number of times, and in this case it crosses an odd number of times. Those are really two topologically distinct possibilities. And they correspond to two distinct types of insulators, band insulators.
The levels don't cross.
How many sets when you go in KX? What guarantees?
So in general, we expect, if there aren't any symmetry reasons, you'll always have an avoided crossing. So if you have two crossings, there'll be some coupling between the two. Is that what you're asking? Why don't I see
yeah.
the crosses? So in general, we expect there to be a splitting.
Oh, I see. So
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Couldn't you have both the bubble and the zigzag?
If
the bubble and the zigzag, then by shifting, you could go from two to one.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you mean.
So you have the bubble, and then there you connect that lower thread to the side.
No, you can't.
The lower thread. But you would never, but you wouldn't change the fact that. So what the claim is, in one case it crosses an even number of times, in one case it crosses an odd number of times. That's.
Never change the fact that it crosses an even number of times.
But why? It could be shifted.
No, then it crosses zero instead of two. So even.
I'll show you the correlation.
So there's two distinct possibilities, and they correspond to two distinct types of insulators. The left-hand side corresponds to the edge spectrum of a conventional insulator, and the right-hand side is the edge spectrum of a topological insulator.
Michael? Yeah. Just to understand, I mean, it's clear that a finite number is either even or odd, but what are the rules? Because in the topological insulator, you let them go into the band. And I guess what some of us are thinking is, why can't they all just go up into the band?
Why can't they?
Why can't any of them just, without crossing, why can't they all, say, just go up into the band? If one or two can go into the band, why can't they all just go up in energy and go into
the band? But in the case, it cannot fall off.
I'm not sure. So what do you want to do here? You want to make
so the rule says that highest state in the topological insulator disappears into the conduction band.
Okay, so the claim is that there's no way you could write down a spectra where they go all up into the band, but that would be the even case, not the odd case.
Okay, so
the point is you can't continuously change this into something where they all go up into the band. Suppose you try to do that, you're gonna you start pulling these up. You know, you can't change the fact that it's, if you start pulling it up, it's always going to cross here.
Okay, so the rule is they can all go into the band, but just still.
Yeah, the fact whether or not they go into the band isn't the important issue. The important thing is here crosses the even times, and here crosses odd, and there's no continuous deformation which could change even to odd. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so there's no reason I couldn't have drawn this going down. I just didn't. This could have gone down.
So if they all went up into the band, it would be a conventional.
Yeah, so I mean, I could, one of the things I'm allowed to do is pull this down, say, so that this goes down. I think you're right. In the conventional case, I could pull them, get rid of them all. But I can't. So that's actually my next point, which is, so yes, let me get to that. So these are these two different types of insulators. So now the question is, what's the physical distinction between the two of them? Well, we already have one, which is looking at their edge. So I said that a conventional insulator always has an even number of edge spectra which cross the Fermi level, whereas a topological insulator always has an odd number. So that means that a conventional insulator has an even number of edge modes, or actually an even number of time reversal pairs of edge modes, because remember, there's another half that we left out here, whereas a topological insulator has an odd number of time reversal pairs of edge modes. Now, a key feature there is, in particular, that means that a topological insulator always has at least one pair of time reversal invariant edge modes, whereas a conventional insulator can have zero. So topological insulators have, in a sense, a protected pair of edge modes that one can never have less than one. It has to be odd. Now, the fact that conventional insulators have an even number of time reversed pairs of edge modes, whereas topological insulators have an odd number of time reversed
comparison to edge modes has an important consequence when you consider a real system with disorder. So normally, when you have a one-dimensional system, like just say a 1D a wire, we expect that if you have disorder, your states will become localized. And that's generally the case. So what that means is that in the case of a conventional insulator, even if you had an even number, even if you were in this weird case over here, where it happens to cross an even number of times, if you include the effects of disorder, those modes would become localized. And in a real sample, you would see no edge mode at all, no delocalized edge mode. So in particular, you would see no conductance at the edge. On the other hand, in a topological insulator, I said there was a protected pair of time-reverse pair of edge modes. Now, I'm not going to prove this, but it turns out that protection exists even in the presence of disorder. So even in the presence of disorder, we will see, generically, we'll see a single pair of edge modes. If we started with three, it would go down to one. So,
for the left-hand case, be in a superconducting state?
In a superconducting state.
Like in two dimensions, you could have sustain of the long range order in two dimensions, right? So if you have a three-dimensional conventional insulators, the edges would be two-dimensional, right?
So this is a one-dimensional edge.
Yeah, but I'm talking about 3D.
Oh, yeah, so I'm not going to discuss that.
No, but I'm just asking, what would happen then? Because in 2D, in 2D there would be weak localization, right? In the without pairing,
mm-hmm.
It would be localized.
I'm not sure about this. I don't know much about the 2D case. In particular, topological insulators, they always have, in the presence of disorder, they have a pair of edge modes. So, and these edge modes, they can carry electric charge. So that means that there's, in general, there's a non-zero conductance at the edge. And if you actually work it out, the conductance is given by 2E squared over H. So this is actually probably the single most important physical distinction, experimental signature, of topological insulators, which is that they're not insulators at all at the edge. They actually conduct, and they have a conductance given by 2E squared over H. Whereas a conventional insulator, because of disorder, it never conducts. Even if it happened to have those two edge modes, they would always get localized, and we'd see zero conductance.
Okay. H is Planck's constant. Sorry, it's sort of cut off. So I've told you a little bit about what these types of insulators are. The next question is, how do you realize them? So let me describe a simple POI model that realizes both conventional insulators and topological insulators. So the TOI model is very simple. So imagine we have electrons confined to two dimensions because we're talking about a 2D system. And imagine that the electrons move in the presence of a magnetic field, a perpendicular magnetic field. And let's imagine further, this is a TOI model, so we can do whatever we want, that this magnetic field is spin dependent. So in other words, spin up electrons feel a magnetic field which points up, and spin down electrons feel a magnetic field that points down. So spin up electrons will do cyclotron motion in one way, and spin down electrons will do cyclotron motion in another way, classically. Formally, one could describe this TOI model as just the normal sort of model of electrons moving in a uniform magnetic field, except for the fact that there's this additional sigma z here, which just tells us that the spin up and spin down electrons feel opposite magnetic fields. So this would be the formal description of this model. Now, a key point is that this model is time reversal invariant. So the reason is that under time reversal symmetry, spin up goes into spin down, but also magnetic field changes sign. So overall, the total system is perfectly time reversal invariant. That's important because, remember, our discussion is all about time reversal invariant systems. So let's think about, let's imagine we have this model, and then let's imagine, let's ask the question of what the energy spectrum looks like for this model. So, if we think about the energy spectrum for the spin-up electrons, they just feel a uniform magnetic field. So they're just going to be some Landau levels with some spacing given by the cyclotron frequency. Similarly, the spin-down electrons will also form Landau levels, and they'll be exactly degenerate with the spin-up electrons. So the toy model we want to consider is we want to imagine a case where we have, we've tuned the filling just right so that we fill up some integer number of these Landau levels. So for example, maybe we fill up two per spin. Then you can see, if you look at this, this does not look so different from our picture of what a band insulator was. We have these bands, they're filled, there's a gap. It's a time reversal invariant system. So one can actually ask the same question. One can ask the question, the basic question, is this a topological insulator or is it a conventional insulator? This toy model. So before I address that question, I just want to do one quick digression about another property of this system, which is that this model, these states, they have an interesting property, which is they demonstrate a spin Hall effect. So what do I mean by that? Well, imagine you apply an electric field to the system in some direction in the plane. How does the system respond? Well, remember, the spin up electrons feel magnetic field in one direction. So they're going to move. There's going to be some current of spin up electrons in one direction, perpendicular to E. But the spin down electrons, they feel the opposite magnetic field. So they're going to move in the opposite direction. So overall, in response to this electric field, there's no net electric current. These two currents are canceled. But there is a spin current. And the spin current is proportional to the electric field. This effect, the fact that you get a spin current in response to an electric field, is a spin Hall. It's called the spin Hall effect. And the coefficient here is called the spin Hall conductivity. Now, if you go ahead and you actually calculate the spin Hall conductivity for this toy model, you find it's basically given by the n, the number of Landau levels multiplied by some constants. So this will become important later on, but for the moment, this is sort of a digression. So let's go back to the original question, which is, are these states topological insulators or are they conventional insulators? So to do that, to understand the answer to that question, let's think a little bit about edge modes in the system. So you can get a good picture of edge modes from a very classical or semi-classical line of thinking. So remember that the spin-up electrons are doing cyclotron motion classically in one direction, while the spin-down electrons are doing cyclotron motion in the opposite direction. So if you think about a little bit what happens near the edge, you can see that the spin-up electrons, you can kind of guess there'll be an edge mode for spin-up electrons moving in one direction, and an edge mode for spin-down electrons moving in the opposite direction. Now, if you actually are more careful, you find that and you actually solve the equations in the presence of an edge, this analysis is borne out. You find that, in general, you don't just get one edge mode for the spin-up electrons and one edge mode for the spin-down. In general, you get n edge modes, where n is the number of Landau levels that you've filled up. So in that case that I showed before, where we filled up two, you would see two edge modes for spin-up electrons going to the right and two edge modes for spin-down electrons going to the left. Now, once we know this, we now can apply what we know about topological insulators and conventional insulators to tell us how to classify these systems. Because we know whenever n is even, remember, when we have an even number of edge modes, that's a conventional insulator, whereas when we have an odd number of time-reverse pairs of edge modes, that's a topological insulator. So their toy model with n even is a model of a conventional insulator. The toy model with n odd is a model of a topological insulator. And what is n here? N is just the number of filled Landau levels per spin, or equivalently, one can think of it as the spin Hall conductivity in appropriate units. I've given you a toy model which realizes both conventional insulators and topological insulators. The next question is, how are these actually realized in a real system, a real material? So it turns out that this toy model isn't as far from a real system as you might think. And to see that, let's think a little bit about let's think about spin orbit coupling. The general form for a spin orbit interaction of electron moving in some potential V is given by the momentum of the electron crossed with the gradient of V dotted into the spin of the electron. Now, you can get some intuition for this by noticing that p is basically pretty similar to velocity, v. Grad of the potential is basically like an electric field, e. So this is just like v cross e dot into sigma. V cross e is nothing but the magnetic field that the electron feels in its rest frame. So this is something like a Zeeman coupling between the spin of the electron and the magnetic field in its rest frame. So let's think a little bit about this term. V, as I said, is the potential the electron feels. Okay? Now, in general, V depends on all three directions. And the reason is, remember, our system is going to be some kind of, we're confining our electrons to some kind of 2D, pseudo-2D system. So V will have some kind of, it will depend on X and Y, because there'll be some kind of periodic potential coming from atoms. But it'll also depend on Z, because it's, the electron is confined to this wafer. So in general, V depends on all three directions. However, it's often a good approximation, and that dependence may be complicated. However, it's often a good approximation to assume that V has a symmetry with respect to reflection about the Z equals zero plane. So if you assume that there's this kind of near symmetry, if the system is symmetric with respect to reflection about the z equals zero plane, then this term simplifies. If you make this assumption, which is a good approximation in many cases, most of the terms drop out, and the only term you get is something that looks like p dot a sigma z, where a is some kind of fictitious vector potential, which is just given by some derivatives of v, the potential v. Now, if you look at this for a second, you can see this looks a lot like an effective spin-dependent magnetic field. It's just like that Hamiltonian I wrote down a few slides ago. So what we've shown here is that spin-orbit coupling, at least in some approximation, looks a lot or can generate an effective spin-dependent magnetic field. Now, of course, this magnetic field will not be, this isn't exactly, so this is similar to the toy model, but it isn't exactly the toy model, right? For one thing, there's no reason why this magnetic field will be uniform. In general, it would be periodic, because remember, the magnetic field depends on the potential, and the potential is periodic. So it's, while it's not a uniform magnetic field, while it's not exactly the toy model, one might guess that that this kind of model might be in the same universality class as the toy model. That is, it might be possible to continuously connect it to the toy model. So that's the basic idea, that spin-orbit coupling can create something which is something somewhat similar to the toy model that has the same properties and the same type of edge modes. Okay, so now let me discuss how it's actually how this occurs in a real system. So the idea is the following. A group, Bernevig et al., studied the band structure in a particular type of material. It's a quantum well composed out of cadmium telluride, mercury cadmium telluride, and cadmium telluride. And they calculated basically the band structure of this system as a function of this thickness of this middle region, D. And what they found is that when D is less than some critical thickness, DC, they found the spin hall conductance or conductivity was zero. So they predicted that this would be a conventional insulator. When D was greater than DC, they found the spin hall conductivity was one. So they predicted this would be a topological insulator. And not long after they made this prediction, a group in Germany went ahead and tried to verify it. So what they did was they looked for the basic signature of topological insulators, which is this conductance at the edge. So they looked at several samples. The first two samples were constructed so that D was less than DC. So what does that mean? Remember, when D is less than DC, the prediction is that these are conventional insulators. What they found was when they gated the system so it was in the insulating regime, they found that the resistance is extremely large, as predicted in a in a conventional insulator. On the other hand, they looked at two other samples with D greater than DC. Whoops. So these are predicted to be topological insulators. And they found there that in the insulating regime, they found the conductance was non-zero, and not only non-zero, but not far from the predicted value of 2E squared over H. So the final piece of evidence from this experiment was that the two samples, 3 and 4, actually had different widths. So that, you know, they had different width to their bar, whatever, where they were measuring the conductance. Now, if the conduction was occurring in the bulk of the sample, you would expect that a wider sample would have a larger conductance. In particular, you would expect 3 and 4 to have different conductances. But what they find is that the conductance is more or less the same. And that's perfectly consistent with the fact that this conductance is actually occurring at the edge, because conduction at the edge doesn't care at all about the width. Okay, so this is all I'm going to say about the review of conventional topological insulators. Are there any questions about this before I go to the my work? Yeah?
The larger voltages where the resistance falls off.
I think this is, as you're tuning the gate voltage, you're going from, this is an insulating regime, here you're tuning the chemical potential through one of the bands. It's going to be becoming metallic again. Okay.
Sure. Yeah, how far away from DC are those distances, do you know?
I don't remember.
What would happen if D was DC?
That's a good question. So I guess the prediction is, in that case, you would, the gap must close. Okay. So it wouldn't really be an insulator at all. It would have maybe a Dirac node or something at the D.
Just a curiosity, you described what's like integer spin Hall effect.
Yeah.
Is there a fractional version of that?
That's a very good question, because that's what I'm trying to talk about next. Okay, so let me go on to the second topic. So the question that I wanted to address is, you know, everything we've been talking about up till now has been about non-interacting or weakly interacting systems. And so the question I wanted to address is, can one make any sense of these ideas in strongly interacting or strongly correlated systems? Are there analogs of topological insulators there? Are there protected edge modes there? And generally, this is kind of a unexplored territory. Everything we know is about the weakly interacting case. So how to proceed? Well, our starting point was to go back to this toy model. So recall that earlier I told you of a toy model of electrons in a spin-dependent magnetic field. I showed you that, or argued that at integer filling, if we took this toy model at integer filling, we could construct band insulators, and depending on whether the filling was even or odd, we could get topological insulators or trivial insulators. We could get things with protected edge modes or without protected edge modes. So now what I want to do is generalize this toy model to get strongly correlated insulators. And the way to do that, or one way to do that, is very simple. So I should say here that the goal is just to get any model, any kind of toy model, of a strongly correlated insulator. We're not going to worry yet how to actually realize it. So how can we actually get one of these strongly correlated insulators? Well, we can just modify the toy model in a simple way. So we'll do two things. First, we'll include interactions between the electrons. And second, we'll consider fractional filling. So instead of filling it up to an integer, filling an integer number of Landau levels, we'll fill up a fractional number of Landau levels. Now, it's not hard to convince yourself that for appropriate interactions and filling, it's possible that to construct the toy model where the ground state corresponds to having a fractional quantum Hall state for each spin rather than an integer quantum Hall state. So for example, if we filled it up to filling nu equals 1/3 and we included appropriate interactions, one could have a ground state that looks like this state where the spin up electrons form a Laughlin state, a Laughlin fractional quantum Hall state with filling fraction 1/3, and the spin down electrons form a Laughlin state with filling fraction 1/3, but with the opposite chirality. So, you know, this is clearly much more general than this particular state. One could imagine a whole zoo of states. There are many different fractional quantum Hall states one can imagine, and many different filling fractions. So one can imagine constructing many, many different types of strongly correlated insulators in this way. So the question we wanted to know ask is, what are these insulators, is there anything like a topological insulator there? Do any of these insulators have protected edge modes? Is there the same kind of classification that exists in the non-interacting case? How do we know whether a particular state, let's say this state, has a protected edge mode or not? What's the criteria? So what we found was, indeed, some of these states have protected edge modes and some don't. Some are somewhat analogous to topological insulators and some are not. And there's a simple criteria for telling which one is which. So the criteria is there's a protected edge mode if and only if sigma sh over E star is odd. Now, what is sigma sh? Remember, sigma sh, I told you what it was earlier. This is the spin Hall conductivity in units of E over 2 pi. E star is the defined to be the smallest charged excitation in the system. So it's the elementary charge in units of E. And in general, these systems can have fractional charge, because I'm talking about fractional quantum Hall states. So E star can be a fraction. Now, we call the states which have protected edge modes fractional topological insulators, because they're very much analogous to conventional topological insulators in the sense that they have an edge mode, but they occur in systems with fractional charge and fractional statistics. OK, so this is the main result. And I'm going to explain it to you. But I first want to just point out a few cases. So first thing I want to point out is that this is a generalization of something I told you earlier, which was the integer case, the case where you fill up an integer number of Landau levels. Because remember, in that case, what is E star? E star is just E. It's just the smallest charge excitation of the system is the electron. So E star is just 1 in units of E. And this statement just becomes, there's an edge mode if and only if sigma sh is odd. But that's exactly what we described earlier. There was an edge mode if and only if the n was odd, where n was the number of filled Landau levels. So in that case, so this is just a generalization of that. Now let me just describe a few other cases for you, just so you get a feeling for this formula before I derive it for you.
You think that sigma h star must be an integer?
Yes, it must always be an integer. That you can convince yourself with thinking a little bit. I can discuss that, but I won't do it quite yet. Maybe at the end. So let me give you a few examples of this beyond the integer case. So here are a few examples. So suppose we have the case I wrote down earlier, which was a Laughlin state, where spin up electrons form a Laughlin mu equals 1/3 state, and spin down electrons form a Laughlin mu equals 1/3 state with the opposite chirality. Does that have a protected edge mode or not? So we can figure that out pretty easily. So what is sigma sh? Well, the spin Hall conductivity in general, it's just the filling fraction. So this is just 1/3. What is E star? Well, the smallest charge excitation in the system is E over 3. So E star is just 1/3. So the ratio of the two of them, 1/3 over 1/3, is 1, which is odd. So we conclude there is a protected edge mode in this case. What about another kind of state, the so-called hierarchical quantum Hall state at nu equals 2/5? So in that case, the spin Hall conductivity is, again, it's just the filling fraction, so that's 2/5. What is the elementary charge? Well, if you study the state for a little bit, you can show the elementary charge is E over 5. So the E star is just 1/5. So the ratio of the two is 2, which is even. So there's no protected edge mode for this state. Finally, I'll mention one other case, which is the strong pairing state, so-called strong pairing state, which occurs at filling fraction 1/2. Does that have a protected edge mode? So in that case, the sigma sh is, again, it's just the filling fraction, so that's 1/2. E star, you might guess, is 1/2 if you were just looking at the pattern. But it's not. It's not always the denominator. It's 1/4. So the ratio of the two
is 2, which is even, so there's no protected edge mode for this state.
Yes, there's no protected edge mode in that case either.
In fact, 7/3 would have a...
7/3 none.
No, no,
sorry.
3/7.
Which one is that? Is that, when you're talking about...
Hierarchy.
Right, 3/7 would. But it isn't always the reason why I put this case here is you might conjecture that you have a protected edge mode if and only if you have an odd number of edge modes, sort of, per spin. But that's not true, as you can see from Storming Pairing. This has one edge mode per spin, but isn't. But you're right, for like 1/3, 2/5, 3/7, it follows that pattern. Okay, so now let me give you an argument to derive this formula. Now, there's two ways you can derive it. One is a microscopic argument where one actually goes in and works out the edge theory and shows that in some cases there's no perturbation which can gap out the edge of these states, and in some cases there is a perturbation. But there's another approach, which is a very general argument, which doesn't involve any microscopic analysis, and that's the argument I'm going to present to you now. So this argument is called a flux insertion argument, and it's illuminating to first see it in the integer case. So let me present it in that case. So in the integer case, so how does the argument work? So let's imagine we put our system on a cylinder. So we have our integer toy model, and it's defined on a cylinder. Let's imagine we change the flux through the cylinder. We start playing with the flux through the cylinder. Now, let's assume that at zero flux, the ground state is time reversal invariant and non-degenerate, okay? So the way the argument's going to work is I'm going to show that that there is always a low-lying state at zero flux. There's always a state at low energy at zero flux. No matter what perturbation I add to this toy model, I can never get rid of this low-lying state. And that's going to be a signature of the fact that there's a gapless edge mode on the edge here, on the edge of the cylinder. So how does the argument work? How do we show that there's this low-lying state? So, we start out at zero flux, and we assume, by definition, that the ground state is non-degenerate and time reversal invariant. So we have some state phi naught. Yes, E is a many-body energy. This is all many-body, but I'm going to present it in the integer case first just because it's easier. But everything is many-body here. So we start off with some state psi naught. Now we're going to adiabatically insert flux. So what's going to happen? So psi naught will adiabatically evolve to some other state, psi plus. We're going to adiabatically insert, I should say, half a flux quantum. So that's pi flux. So we adiabatically insert half a flux quantum, psi naught evolves to some state psi plus. Now, let's adiabatically insert minus half a flux quantum. So psi naught will evolve some other state, psi minus. Okay, now let's think a little bit about these two states, psi plus and psi minus. So there are a couple properties to them. So first property is that psi plus and psi minus are eigenstates of the same Hamiltonian. Why is that? That's because one is at plus phi naught over 2, and the other is at minus phi naught over 2. As far as electrons are concerned, these are the same. These are the same flux. So these are actually the same Hamiltonian. These are eigenstates of the same Hamiltonian. So they're eigenstates of the same Hamiltonian. The second thing you should notice is that they're time-reverse partners of one another. Why is that? Well, that's because we started with a time-reversal invariant state, and in this case, we inserted plus phi naught over 2 flux. In this case, we inserted minus phi naught over 2 flux. So they have to be time reverse. Every point here is a time reverse partner of the opposite point here. In particular, these guys are time reverse partners of each other. So they're time reverse partners of each other. They must have the same energy, as we have a time reversal invariant Hamiltonian. So we conclude that these are degenerate eigenstates at half a flux quantum. Now, the question I want to ask is, let's start adding a perturbation to the system. Because remember, this toy model has a strange property. It has perfect SZ conservation. But let's add an arbitrary time reversal invariant perturbation, something that breaks SZ conservation, but is still time reversal invariant, some kind of spin orbit coupling, let's say. And let's ask, what happens to this degeneracy?
Does the degeneracy between these two states split, or does it remain? We add an arbitrary perturbation. So to answer that question, we need to understand the relationship between psi plus and psi minus a little better. So let's figure out how let's think about how we can get from psi minus to psi plus. So one way to get from psi minus to psi plus is to insert a full flux quantum. Because remember, one is at minus a half flux quantum, and the other is at plus a half flux quantum. So we can get from one to the other by inserting a full flux quantum. So what happens when we insert a full flux quantum? Well, by Faraday's law, as we change the flux, it's going to generate some electric field, E here, transverse to the direction the flux is being inserted. And then remember, these states have a spin-Hall conductivity. So in response to E, there's going to be some spin current in the longitudinal direction. Now, if you actually work out the numbers, you find that in this process of inserting a single flux quantum, you find that this process transfers n spin-up electrons from the left edge to the right edge, and n spin-down electrons from the right edge to the left edge. So that's what happens. That's how psi minus and psi plus are related. So in particular, that means that psi plus and psi minus differ by flipping n spins at the edge. Now, if n is odd, that means that these are a Cramer's pair. They're time-reverse partners, and they differ by flipping n spins. These are Cramer's pair. So if they're Cramer's pair, no time-reversal invariant perturbation can split them. So the degeneracy can't split, even if I add an arbitrary perturbation. And this is important, because now we can prove there's a low-lying state whenever n is odd. So to see that, let's look at our diagram. So we show that there's always going to be these two states that are degenerate here at half a plus quantum, even after we add some perturbation. Now, one of these states, psi plus, was adiabatically connected to psi naught here. But the other one, psi minus, must also be adiabatically connected to something. So we follow it back to some state here. And this state must be this is some kind of excited state. It has to have low energy, because these inserting fluxes can't change the energy very much. You can make that precise. So in this way, we've proved there is a low-lying excited state. And it's always there as long as n is odd. So as long as n is odd, you have this low-lying excited state. And we take that to mean the edge cannot be gapped. OK. So now let's try to make the same argument in the more general case. So there's one subtlety in doing that, which is that in the fractional case, there are always low-lying states on the cylinder, even if the edge is gapped out completely. These low-lying states have nothing to do with gapless edge modes. They have nothing to do with time-reversal symmetry. It's a totally different structure. These low-lying states correspond to different topological sectors of the theory on a cylinder. They come from the fact that the fractional case has something called topological order, and this topological order implies the existence of these this sort of degeneracy on a cylinder. Now, I can't explain exactly what topological sectors are in the time I have, but let me just mention one thing about them, which is that you might ask, well, what's the difference between these different topological sectors? How do I tell if two states are in the same sector or in different sectors? So it turns out that the difference between them is subtle. If you want to tell the difference between a state which is in one topological sector and one that's in another, the way you would tell is you'd take a quasiparticle and you would drag it around in a circle like this and compute the Berry states. And the different topological sectors are distinguished by the fact that you get different Berry states for this process. It's a kind of very non-local difference between these sectors. They don't differ by some local operation at the edge. There's something quite, that's why we call them topological sectors. You can't change one into the other by some local operation. So the existence of these topological sectors is a slight annoyance, because it means if we just show that there's a low-lying state, we won't be done. What we really have to show is that there's a low-lying state in the same topological sector as the ground state. That would be an interesting low-lying state and would be evidence for a gapless edge. So how do we do that? Well, we do the same thing we did before, except we insert more than half a flux quantum. We insert m halves of a flux quantum, where we choose m large enough so that these two states are in the same sector. So if you choose m large enough, you can guarantee that. And what is m? Well, I don't have time to show this to you, but you can prove that m is just 1 over e star in general. You have to insert 1 over e star halves of a flux quantum to make sure that these two guys are in the same sector. So now the argument proceeds just as before. We insert these flux quanta. We get these two states, psi plus and psi minus. And then we note that we ask whether the degeneracy between them can be split. And we note that they differ by flipping not n spins, but rather sigma sh times m spins, where m is just 1 over e star. So these two states differ by flipping sigma sh over e star spins. If sigma sh over e star is odd, then as before, these two states must be a Cramer's pair. The degeneracy can't be split. And then, as before, we deduce there must be a low line state. So whenever this quantity is odd, we can show by this sort of general argument that there's a low line state in the same sector as the ground state. And this is evidence that the edge cannot be gapped.
Large, then you stand in some sector?
So maybe one example maybe would clarify. So if you take the Laughlin state, for example, and you insert a flux quantum through, you drill a little hole. Actually, this is the case you might be more familiar with. You take a Laughlin sample on a plane like this, and you drill a little hole, and you insert flux through this hole. Like this. So if you insert single flux quantum, phi naught, and this creates a charge E over 3 quasiparticle here. It's in a different sector from, this is a topologically non-trivial excitation. It's a different sector. But if I insert 3 flux quanta, and I get an electron here, it's in the same sector as the original state. And 3 here, this is exactly the same situation as on a cylinder. If I insert a single flux quanta, for this double Laughlin state, I'll get something non-trivial involving E over 3 particles. But if I insert 3 of them, I'll get something involving electrons in the 2 edges. So that's sort of an idea. Okay, so let me summarize. So in summary, I've tried to show you that one can generalize topological insulators to strongly interacting systems, and there's structure there that's very much analogous to the non-interacting case. There are systems with protected edge modes, there are states with protected edge modes and states without. And I also presented a general criteria for telling whether something is a topological insulator or not. And the criteria is you have a fractional topological insulator, that is, you have a protected edge mode if and only if sigma sh over e star is odd. And that's it. So thank you for your attention.
Have a U1 spin symmetry. So have you considered the case looking at fractional topological insulators without that? So you'll have a Z2 spin symmetry. Is there anything you might really think you could really get a new main body state as opposed to copies of Laughlin states?
You have Z2. So so you can be more general than just copies of Laughlin states. So you can have, I didn't present it here, but you can have interactions between the up and down spins, and you can still apply this approach. Now, what is important, at least in writing down a simple formula, is that you have SZ conservation. The reason is that without SZ conservation, I can't... the key feature is I have to show, after inserting this flux, that these two states, psi plus and psi minus, are Cramer's pairs. So I have to know whether they're Cramer's pairs or not. And spin is like a good proxy for that. If I know they differ by flipping n spins, then at least in appropriate circumstances, I know that they're Cramer's pairs. So a key feature of writing down at least a simple criteria is that I have this SZ conservation. But I should point out that you can break SZ. Suppose you start from one of these states that has SZ conservation, and you use this formula and you say, okay, it's a topological insulator. You can go ahead and break SZ conservation, add a small perturbation, and certainly the edge modes are robust. That was like, that's what basically what we showed. But to write down a formula, the initial formula, you need SZ conservation.
Want to break SZ, sigma SH is not defined.
That's right, absolutely. So the point is that what you're trying to do is write down, so suppose someone gives you some arbitrary state which doesn't have SZ conservation. It's hard to know what to do with it. But suppose you know that state is close to a state which does have SZ conservation.
then you can tell the state that it's close to, you can use this formula and see that it's what the classification is, and then deduce what your original state was. That's actually the same approach that the Brnovich et al. Did in the integer case for this real material, because there they didn't have SC conservation exactly, but it's a good approximate symmetry. So they started with the kind of case with the exact SC conservation, calculate the spin hall connectivity, they can see it's odd, and then they could deduce what the real system is. So we're kind of trying to do the same thing. Ideally, you want to be able to do it without ever going to this SC conserved special point, but that's a harder question.
Are these things only defined in lower dimensions, or are there three-dimensional?
There are three-dimensional topological insulators. In fact, they probably are more famous than the two-dimensional ones. And actually, that's another interesting topic, is can one do something like this, add interactions to the three-dimensional story? There are three-dimensional ones, and they have protected surface modes rather than edge modes. It's kind of, in some ways, a similar story.
Is there some analog of the spin hall?
No, not that I know of. The problem is these models, among other things, you can't write down a model which is SC conserving. So there is no special point one can go to which is SC conserving and look at some quantity of this in three-dimensional ways.
If using this K matrix for the K minus K, whether one can express this criterion in terms of K matrix?
Yes.
So it's a different formula,
just
that.
Yeah, it's just like, so sigma sh would just be, so if you had, so let's see. You have to write what sigma sh is. So sigma sh would just be something like T, K inverse T, where T is the charge vector. So imagine the charge vector looks like something like this.
I see.
And then you have to write down what E star is. So that's actually slightly harder. That involves looking at some greatest common multiples and various entries of K inverse. But you can write it down.
So in this case, you kind of have some expression without spin rotation, without SC conservation.
Well, this in a sense does have SC conservation, right? Because
no, they don't have.
You're assuming that these are spin up electrons and these are spin down electrons, right? So implicitly, and maybe I misunderstood your question.
This symbol even works if you break as the rotation.
It comes down to the same point again. If you're near a point which is exactly as the conserving, you could use this.
In your flux-limiting argument for the fractional case, is it true that if you take finite over 2 that it's still time-reversible invariant if you have fractional charges? Because I would think that finite over 2 is no longer the time-reversible invariant point. It's actually in finite over 2.
The Hamiltonian is time-reversible invariant. The ground state is not. But actually, it's not. The ground state is not, or even in the integer case, psi plus and psi minus are different states. They differ by flipping some spins. The reason you have to insert m phi not over 2 is not to make sure that psi plus psi minus are the same, but rather to make sure that they differ by something that's just some number of electrons. They don't differ by like an e over 3 particle or something topologically non-trivial. So you're trying to get a weaker criteria.
So is there some correlated Hamiltonian you can write down some spin model which has a fractional topological?
You can certainly write down models which do it. The question is, can one get it from a real material?
I'm interested in the first question too. So, what do the models look like?
Oh, so it would just be. It's almost trivial. You take two separate copies of. Maybe misunderstood your question. You can have a Hamiltonian for which the Laughlin state is an exact ground state. You take two copies of that.
Maybe go on to the next one then.
Okay, so the question of how to realize it in a real system, there are all kinds of questions there. So, first question one can ask is, so these toy models, the one I just mentioned to you, have a special property, which is that they only have interactions. Interactions are not SU2 invariant, like spin-up spins interact with spin-up spins, spin-down spins interact with spin-down spins, but there's no interaction between spin-up and spin-down. So clearly that's not very realistic. So you might ask, okay, suppose I start from this toy model where I know that it's realized, and I go to the SU2 invariant point. where spin up spins and spin down spins interact, you know, isotropically, you know, with each other. I can ask the question, does the gap close? So this is an interesting question and requires numerical work. There's reason to think that it might not. It's actually, there's reason to think that it might persist even to the SU2 invariant point. So that's one step towards reality. Now, if you want to go beyond that, like actually get it from a real material from spin orbit coupling, there are all kinds of subtleties because you know, spin orbit coupling can generate bands that are sort of like churn number one or churn number minus one bands. We need like an integer quantum Hall effect. But here we need, that's not quite the same thing as a Landau level. I mean, it has the same churn number, but it's not, you know, Landau levels are exactly flat. They have a lot of other properties. So it isn't clear how spin orbit coupling can give you something, can necessarily be a fractional quantum spin Hall. It's an open question.
The criterion you've stated involves a, what you might call a macroscopic transport coefficient.
Uh-huh.
Is there some sort of microscopic intuition or picture you can say that explains what's different between the fractional, the topological insulator and the normal insulator?
Microscopic. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, one can give a more microscopic derivation of this formula. I don't know if that's what you mean. So one can, instead of giving this flux insertion argument, one can actually look at the real edge theory and ask, can I add a perturbation to gap it out or not? And you find that it's kind of magically, whenever this is odd, you can't add a perturbation to gap it out without breaking time reversal symmetry.
But I guess another way of asking is, what kind of materials would give the one behavior and what would give the other?
Oh.
What is
so
different about them sort of at a microscope? Is there something?
I see. So you want to get, right. Even in the integer case, that's a question, right? Which is, how do you guess whether a material is going to be a topological insulator or conventional insulator? I think you need strong spin orbit coupling. That's about, I don't really know much about it, what the heuristics are. I mean, in principle, you need to compute this coefficient, but maybe you can guess it in certain cases.
But when you have this topological insulator, but you don't feel the band, you say only one third field,
exactly.
then turn on a lot of
interaction. Well, that's what we're, that's the candidate for doing this. But I guess the point I was making was,
yeah,
it's not quite the same thing as taking a third of a Landau level, because Landau levels are flat in energy,
yeah,
whereas this will have some dispersion and other differences. But it's certainly in principle, if it's flat enough, and uniform enough, it could do it. There's nothing wrong with it in principle. I don't know if it actually happens.
So thank you very much.